When I was in junior high and in high school, my sisters were in college, and while I actually didn't move all that often, it felt like they were moving on a near constant basis. It felt like every summer we had the joyful responsibility of helping them move yet again. And it always seemed to play out about the same way. There would be an early wake-up call sometime in the summer, and there would be a promise of breakfast, which immediately should have made me suspicious, because breakfast came on Sundays and special occasions, and a random Saturday in the summer is not a special occasion. But there was that promise of breakfast, that call for breakfast, and you could almost see it. It worked a lot like a Looney Tunes comic. He just sort of took the breakfast and let us out, and threw it into the car, and then waited for us to jump into the car, and then close the door, and then we started driving off. And, you know, 40 or 50 seconds after we started eating, we would be done, and we'd look up, and we'd ask, where are we going? And it would be that same promise. Well, we're going to go move your sister. My father would relate to us that he was grateful that he had girls first and boys later, because he didn't think he would have the energy to move girls later in life, and boys get to move themselves, so they could all figure it out on their own. So that was his encouraging comments as we drove to go with my sisters. We would show up and climb 20 to 30,000 stairs, because apparently no one ever moves on the first floor ever, so, you know, we'd ascend whatever number of stairs are required and got to move the furniture again, which I'm fairly certain that my sisters picked out their furniture under the following criteria. It had to be heavy enough to kill you if it fell on you, and it had to be at least four times more dense than the average piece of material of the same kind. So, you know, we hauled these things patiently up and down stairs, not to mention that half of every inventory would be books. And no matter how much we try, we still can't fill the entire box with books and not kill someone with it. So, you know, we had to space it out so that we didn't run out in that sense. Of course, the challenge was that when I was in junior high and high school, while I could do these things with a fair amount of skill, it did require a lot of power, so they had to feed me on a regular basis every 3 to 4 hours. If they didn't feed me, I basically just sort of curled up in a ball and just sort of waited and just sort of stopped and considered my possibilities. And it would happen near every move. You know, there would be that comment eventually that would go something like this. I would sit down to take a rest because I was out of food, and they would always say, you know, you eat a lot. And I would smile and look at them and say, you know, you could hire someone else to do this. And then the staring contest would always end with, there's another menu on the fridge, call it, whatever you need to order, order it, and it'll be here, and just keep working. So, you know, it worked its way out. But, you know, it was a fascinating thing as I think about it. I was thinking about that as we come to the Book of Kings here, and what does Elijah do? Elijah goes a journey into the desert. Why does he go out into the desert? Well, Ahaz is trying to kill him. He has the king of Israel who's ready to kill him because he proved the king of Israel wrong, and instead of actually admitting that he was wrong, it seemed easier just to kill Elijah, so he's trying to kill him. Elijah has nothing left. He has nothing. So he lies down under the tree and he waits to die. And what happens? Well, the angel touches him and says, eat. There's a cake and there's water, and he drinks and he eats. Then he goes back to sleep, and the angel wakes him again, and he eats and he drinks and he goes back to sleep. He's starting to sound like a teenager all over again. You know, it's a constant cycle, and yet there's the angel. It says, get up, eat, and go. And he eats, and he sets out on this journey 40 days and nights into the desert. This great challenge, this great struggle, this great difficulty. Because trust me, 40 days and 40 nights wandering around in the desert to find the mountain of God is not a pleasant experience all by itself. And yet he's been nourished, he's been strengthened, he's been given all of the graces and the strength necessary to get there. Fast forward, where do we come to? We come to John. John's trying to tell us something in this gospel. Jesus has fed 5,000 people. He's fed 5,000 people. He's explaining to people that this is a very special kind of opportunity. They can receive the bread from heaven. They don't have to be hungry again. And there's a large crowd following him. This sounds great. He started with 5 loaves. He fed 5,000 people. 1 loaf for 5,000 people sounds like great math to them. He also gave it out without charging anything for it. That sounded even better. Free food. All we got to do is follow this guy around. We get free food every time we follow him around. This sounds fantastic. We can cash in on this immediately. Get rich quick scheme, except I don't have to get rich. I just never have to be hungry. That sounds fantastic. Jesus challenges them. He says, look, I fed you. But what you really should strive for is something more. What you really should strive for is that bread from heaven. And they're like, hey, if that's free, that sounds good too. Let's do that. And then he challenges them. He says, I am the bread from heaven. And then we start up this gospel. Last week we got all of that. We had the preamble. We led into it. We've had several weeks with this. But now he says, I am bread that came down from heaven. And they come face to face with something that is very, very difficult. You know, the free food part was easy. Getting stuff for free, that part was easy. Following them around, that didn't take that much work. They could follow them around as long as there's more food to follow. But now they had to be challenged. There had to be that difficulty they came face to face with. They point out, they say, well, you know, our ancestors ate manna in the desert. That was the bread from heaven. That was free food. It came to our ancestors. It was the free food. Of course, they didn't want to reflect on the part where their ancestors had to wander around in the desert for 40 years. And, you know, they were on the pilgrimage the entire time and constantly had to deal with things like being bitten by seraph serpents and pursued by other nations and constantly harassed by everyone around them. You know, those parts weren't so exciting. But, you know, the free food part, that sounded really good. You know, our ancestors ate manna from heaven. That, you know, that's that food from heaven. We want that part. He says, I am the bread from heaven. And he challenges them. And they come face to face with their own limitation in this moment. Because instead of asking, okay, I don't understand how that works, you're going to have to elaborate for me. Instead of saying, gosh, that sounds really morbid to try and take a bite out of you. Could you perhaps tell me why that is? Instead of seeking answers from the one who actually can provide them with those answers, instead they talk among themselves. They murmur against him. In this murmur, in this moment of discontent, this distress, they decide to circle around. What do? They say, oh, he ain't that impressive. We know who he is. We know where he's from. He may think himself fancy. He may think himself something special. But he's not. We've met him. We know his parents. We know him. Instead of taking on the challenge, they decide they want to pull apart what they think they know. Instead of embracing where they were given, instead of engaging God and actually giving them a chance to fully show them what a great gift it is that he's trying to show them, they murmur against him. They try and pull it apart. They allow the distrust of him to just go into pulling at him from all sides. It's fascinating. Because whether we look at Elijah or we look at John, what we have here is a genuine moment to be reminded that God gives us incredible gifts. He feeds us. He nourishes us. He continually gives us incredible things. Elijah was fed. It just was there. The angel woke up and told him to eat. Jesus fed these people. He gave them bread. He gave them fish, more than they could possibly eat. There were leftovers. He gave them in great abundance. After he fed them, he challenged them to something more. He challenged them to become something greater. Consider it in our own lives. God gives us incredible gifts. I don't think a single one of us was born, and then the very next second after we were born, challenged to go, okay, God says, now I need something from you. I need you to make a commitment right now. I need you to dive deeper into something right now. You know, I realize that your mother's still recovering from the birth, and you still have the messiness of being born, but I need you to make that commitment right now. I don't think anyone's had that. If that is your experience, by all means, come let me know. I'd love to talk about that. But in the meantime, I'm pretty sure that God gave us things before that happened. We were given families. We were given warmth, food, shelter. We were given baptism. How many things did God challenge you to do before you were given an opportunity for the gift of baptism? And I realize that not everybody is baptized when they're born. There are, of course, adult baptisms. There are people who do have to struggle. There are people who do indeed need a little bit more time or whatever it is to get there, just a little bit further. And that's not a criticism. God gives them graces too. God offers us these incredible, wonderful, profound graces, and he wants us to be strengthened by them. And then, after he gives us the graces, after he's given us this nourishment, after he's given us these great things, then he says, I want something from you. I want your faith to come in a little deeper. I want you to come into this struggle a little bit more. The question then falls, when we encounter that difficulty, when we encounter that struggle in our life, how do we receive it? Whether it's the loss of someone near to us, we're struggling with that loss, we're having a hard time coping with and moving on from that person that we were close to. Or we're coming face to face with a teaching or a belief or a practice that we find especially difficult. Whenever it is that we find most challenging, we find most difficult about growing in our faith life, when we come face to face with that challenge, how do we proceed? Do we embrace it? Do we say, I don't know how the next step's going to go, it's really hard, but with you on my side, God, I know I'm going to step in deeper? Or do we murmur? Do we turn to family or friends or neighbors, whoever will support our decision not to follow through, and murmur against it? Do we murmur and say, you know, that's not the way I'm supposed to do this. That's not really how I'm supposed to grow in my prayer life. That's not really how I'm supposed to grow in my faith life. That's not really what's called in my spirituality. No, my spirituality is something else entirely. It's somewhere else, not this. How do we receive it? We have been given incredible gifts. We have received wonderful graces from God. Now it falls to us. When that struggle is going on, when we feel that separation, when we feel that tug, when we feel that pull, how are we going to respond? Can we receive God in His difficulty? When He's hard to wrap our arms around? Or will we just turn to our friends and murmur?